Right, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you for coming. Welcome to this second seminar in the Arcadia series this term. 15 years ago, a Harvard academic named Clayton Christensen published a seminal book about organizations and technology. Its title was The Innovator's Dilemma, and the subtitle was When New Technologies Cause Great Firms to Fail. It's an astonishing book, still, because it showed that much of what we believed about innovation in companies and organizations was actually wrong. Christensen studied firms in the disk drive business, which is the nearest thing management scientists have to fruit flies. And what he found was that sometimes the firms that failed were not those with obvious managerial or strategic flaws, but firms which were the very best at what they did. Ones that stayed close to their customers, produced great products, and generally did everything right. And yet they failed in the face of disruptive technological change. Now, I'm a photographer, and for most of my life, Kodak was the dominant company in my hobby and in the photographic business. It was, to use a cliche, an iconic business. One of its products, Kodachrome, even became the title of a Paul Simon song. And yet Kodak is now bankrupt. And the really astonishing thing is that Kodak more or less invented digital photography. So when I was pondering this mystery of how a company that invented the future then blew it, Becky Allen mentioned to me that there was a scholar in Cambridge who had done a study of Kodak, and so I immediately emailed him. He's Kamal Munir from the Judge Institute, and I'm delighted to have him here to talk about his research. Now, before he sets off on his talk, you might be asking, what has all this to do with libraries? Well, one of the things that struck me during the Arcadia project was the extent to which librarians felt that the quality of the service they provided would be the key to survival and success in a new digital environment. And I remember thinking, well, maybe they're right. But what if they're wrong? So, come on. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here. I didn't even realize that this room existed here in this library. It's a lovely room. The treasures that libraries hide, never cease to amaze me. How do I switch the slides? I'm just wondering. Okay. Okay, so I'm guessing you're here because of Kodak and not because of me. There are two things that you'll have to put up with in this presentation. This being on Kodak is going to be this yellow background in all slides. This is the ubiquitous yellow that Kodak prided itself on. It was probably the most recognized brand in the world at one time. And those yellow boxes were everywhere, from Calcutta to Shanghai to London. And the second thing is the presentation is almost entirely pictures, because it's Kodak. So when I started looking at Kodak, that was more than 10 years ago, Kodak was just beginning to realize what digital photography could actually do it. And this was the late 1990s. I remember digital cameras were introduced back in 1981 by Sony, the first Mavica that was introduced by them, or magnetic video camera, as it was known. And so 1980s, 1990s, 20 years is a long time. And they still couldn't catch up, as John mentioned, despite the fact that they had pretty much invented digital photography. So what happened to Kodak? So this was essentially the question that led me to this study. And what I realized very quickly was, in order to answer why Kodak had this particular mindset, why they did things that they did, I have to actually go back, way back, to how this mindset developed within Kodak, how they came to understand the particular environment in which they functioned. And that took me to the various assumptions that went into Kodak's manager's worldview of what photography was all about. So the first part of the talk is going to be pretty historical. So I'm going to tell you about how Kodak essentially created popular photography. This is of course, from a month ago or so, where they decided to go bankrupt. I mean, total assets now are 5.1 billion. Liabilities exceed that by about 6 billion. It's in the news all over the place, not just in America, but everywhere, simply because it was the dominant company for about 100 years in their industry. And they invented photography. I mean, how many CEOs or founders of companies have had postage stamps printed out of them? But George Eastman was one of them. In fact, there was a time that photography was not called photography, it was called Kodaking. And so coming back to the question that started me on this path was, how could a small technological change do this to a company like Kodak? Was it arrogance? Was it ignorance? Was it just the technology that they couldn't adapt, but they had invented the technology themselves? Was it bad management? What was it? So like I said, in order to answer these questions, let's go back a little bit in time. What came before? This is not the first technological change to hit this industry. There was a time that people used to take pictures on copper plates. They were coated with chemicals, and you had a lens. Light passed through that lens, fell on that copper plate, the chemicals bleached, formed an image, and then you had to coat them with further chemicals to fix the image, and then you had a picture. Now, some of you may have seen those copper plates. Certainly in some museums, they are present. There's an obvious disadvantage to copper plates, right? Can you think of that disadvantage? I mean, there are several, but one of the big disadvantages was that you cannot make reprints. You only have one image of a kind. So at one point, copper plates came to be replaced by glass plates. So glass plates solved that problem. Because now you could shine light. Probably a lot of you have used dark rooms. You could shine light, through a glass plate and have another print through that. You could make multiple prints from a particular image because the glass was now acting as the negative. And then you coated it and so on. But there were also disadvantages because glass is fragile. And you had to travel great distances, of course. This came even before dry plates. This was collodion, which was later replaced by gelatin-based film. So this is a typical pack in which these plates came, for you to take pictures. So you had to carry lots of these plates wherever you went, and these were extremely heavy, right? So one of those cameras. So this is the kind of pack that you had to wear on your back if you were a photographer. And even before this, you basically had to take a horse carriage with you, which had a whole development lab in it. So after this dry plates, with all its disadvantages, what does Kodak do? It introduces the first automatic snapshot camera, which actually has a film in it. What do you think the market's response was? Now, anyone could take pictures. You didn't need professionals. Prior to that, it was completely confined to professionals. Now any one of you could do it. What do you think the market's response was to this great new innovation? Sold like hotcakes?
No.
The market completely rejected it. Why? Because the market at that time was limited to professionals. And the most important thing for professionals was quality of the image. And the quality of the image with film-based cameras was terrible. Because, the kind of advances that were made in film came with the years afterwards. The initial films were made of wax paper. So the image, you can imagine, was quite poor. So the, I mean, this thought that photography was all about preserving memories as accurately as possible, so this was just not good enough. Kodak almost went bankrupt at that time. This is more than 100 years ago, 120 years ago, and almost went back to making dry plates. Rejected this. This is not the account that you will find in most history books, by the way. I had to spend lots of weeks in the basement of the New York Public Library and, you know, visits to Eastman House and so on, going back to primary source material to actually see what was going on. Then it occurred to George Eastman. Eastman really, really believed in this new discovery. He thought this was going to be as successful as telephones, because Alexander Graham Bell had just marketed that particular device, and he thought he had hit upon something like that, of that potential. So he says, you know what? We are ahead of the market. These guys don't understand what they're missing. We need to create a new market for them. So what did they do? They started marketing it, their product, to a completely different market who had never used cameras before. And that market was children. And they introduced the Brownie, which is perhaps, you know, one of their most popular brands ever. The name itself, Brownie, is taken from a children's comic strip at the time, before the 1900s we are talking about. So they introduced the Brownie. It cost about $1, you know, at that time. In fact, in order to popularize this activity in Rochester, if you were a boy or a girl who turned 12, Kodak would send you a free camera loaded with 100 exposure film, of course, which you had to take back to Kodak because they would take the film out and then put in a new film and so on. So it was all focused on children. But then it also occurred to him that if he just focus on children, this could just prove to be a fad, a toy. And we want this camera thing to be taken more seriously than that. So what did they do then? They shifted their target market once again. Okay. There were three things that they did afterwards. First of all, they harnessed the complexity inherent in photography. They produced a camera which only had one button on it, which led them to perhaps their most famous marketing slogan ever, "You push the button, we do the rest." You couldn't go wrong because there was no other button to press. So, which means that all the complexity is hidden. They're making it very, very simple, rather like Apple did with PCs and iMacs later on, much, much later on. So they harnessed the complexity of the technology. Second thing was they started focusing on women. Now, we are talking about 1900. It was considered very unladylike for women to dabble in these contraptions, these cameras. Nice ring tone. But when we come to 1970s or 1980s, so 1980s, everyone is using film-based cameras. Who do you think took more pictures, men or women? Women? Some of you are not very sure. Some of you are shaking your head. About between 60 and 70% of pictures, because it differs from culture to culture, market to regional market to market. Let's talk about the biggest photography market in the world, which is the United States. Between 60 and 70% of the pictures in the 1980s were taken by women. Now the question is, how do we get from zero women to 70% women? Does it happen all by itself? No. Kodak played a very, very central role in this, and I'll show you how they did that. So second thing was focusing on women, and the third thing was making you realize that you actually wanted to use this camera. You needed to use this camera. So I'm going to show you how they did that. So this was the technology. You press the button, we do the rest. So women, post-1900, They created an advertising blitz for several decades. Because magazines had just come out, publishing, color magazines, so this was a great new medium for advertising. In all their ads, who do you think was holding the camera? Women. What kind of pictures were they taking? Children, domestic bliss, right? Yeah. And they gave people albums to keep these pictures in. And the idea was that it's not just the rich and the famous people who should have a history of their families. Everyone should have a history. Everyone is equally important. So this was also in keeping with the new sort of democratic spirit that was all around them. So again, even with the brownie, now it's no longer children, it's a woman who's taking the picture. Now, before you think that, you know, I mean, Kodak was this great feminist company emancipating women all over from, I mean, one of the magazines that I was looking into during my research from 1870s, 70s, I forget the exact date, but this gives you an idea of the kind of attitudes that existed at that time. You know, those agony aunt columns in newspapers. So this was a priest who was answering your questions about morality, rituality, and ethics, and that kind of thing. A woman had written to the priest that, dear father, or, you know, dear so-and-so, I realize that it's sinful for women to ride bicycles, but it's the only means of transportation that I have to get to church. So what do I do? it's a real tricky one. So, and he had answered that, you know, since it's the only means, but I'm no, you know, sort of, by no means condoning this practice, but if it's your only means of getting to church, then you may, you know, make an exception in this case. So similar attitudes existed towards photography at the time. And so this was, you know, I mean, going for women and cultivating this new market segment really broke away from the trend and the prevalent attitudes at the time. This was an employee magazine, and even on the top of that, it was a woman, because that was the new sort of focus at Kodak now. You were going to focus on women. And what were they trying to do when focusing on women? Yes, I mean, part of it was emancipation, and you know, there was all that rhetoric around that. But at the same time, there was also the new line of cameras called the Vanity Kodak, which came in five lovely colors, right, to harmonize with one's costume. Yeah. But so, I mean, they were focusing on women, and the idea very much was that if you want to be seen as a responsible mother, a responsible housewife, a caring mother, right, a loving wife, you need to preserve all the significant occasions in your family's life, the weddings, the christenings, and so on and so forth. So they basically bestowed this role of family archivist on women. Okay. And this is how Kodak understood women. Their most lucrative market segment until the 1990s was what they called soccer moms. So a woman in her mid-30s, two kids, a dog, minivan, lives in the suburbs, takes her kids to soccer practice, football, and takes lots and lots of pictures that she then shares over coffee mornings. The most lucrative segment for Kodak. You know, this was the stereotype, and they had created it in sort of a large part, and it was delivering for them. Okay. So again, it's the woman who's preserving those moments of, you know, domestic bliss. The other thing that they came to was significant occasions. Now, prior to Kodak, nobody felt the need to use a camera. Remember, people used to write diaries to preserve memories. So here was a new artifact now. Here was a new practice that they were giving to you. This was, you know, you could just take a picture. What are significant occasions? you need to remember that prior to Kodak, there was no such thing as a Kodak moment. It didn't exist in popular imagination. That is not how people thought. Photographs were taken of affluent people who went and posed in studios, and then they were hung in hallways and so on. So this was everyday life. These were considered very, very mundane moments which were not worth photographing. So they are trying to sell this to people. First, they have created a subject position, which is women who are going to be the family archivists. And alongside that, they're trying to tell you what are those moments that you need to preserve. So the first thing they did was weddings, christenings, birthdays. You need to preserve those. If you don't have keep a meticulous record of your family's, you know, historical evolution, you're not a caring mother. You're not a loving wife. You don't care. And in marketing, you know, you see several companies using that kind of, you know, those strategies. So they did that. Plus, they came to travel. There used to be such a thing as travel. Travel connoted adventure, meeting the unexpected. You went out and you actually lived in places for months, sometimes years. And then you came back with lots of stories of how particular civilizations, tribes, cultures function. Now, Kodak was not the only one, but they played a big role in turning travel into tourism. Tourism is basically about the antithesis of travel. Whereas travel was about adventure and meeting the unexpected, this is about making sure that you don't meet anything unexpected. So just go and observe yourself. Just go on a weekend outside King's College Chapel and look at people's behavior. There'll be a big shuttle that will come and stop in front of a coach. You come and stop in front of King's College. 80 people will shuffle out of the coach. One by one, they will stand in front of the chapel and get their picture taken. And then, what happens? Then they all shuffle back into the coach and they go to the next point in the itinerary. By the way, if you ever see me getting into one of those, just shoot. But this is what epitomizes tourism. I was sitting at Boston Logan Airport a couple of years ago. And I could hear a group of women sitting behind me. It was peak, travel season, peak July or August. And I could overhear them. One was asking the other, so what are you doing this summer? She said, I'm doing Rome, Florence, Milan, and a few other cities. He said, I did those last year. This year, I'm doing these. So you don't go to cities anymore. You do cities. Right? You basically tick them off your list. And who started this? 100 years ago, they come out with this ad. You've gone to a holiday, you haven't got any pictures to show for it, you might as well have not gone. What's the point? So people go to take pictures, right? You go to your hotel reception and tell them, I have 3 hours to my flight. Tell me two things that I should see. And what you will do is, you will be in Paris, you will go to the Eiffel Tower, stand in front of it, get a picture taken, the same image that you've consumed about a million times in magazines, but now you've been there. Okay? You've been there and you've done it. Okay? So that's it. You've done your duty. Now you can come back and tell people that I'm a world traveler. So again, this was tourism that Kodak gave to the world. Budget tours, this, that. How many of you have been to Hawaii? Yeah. Hula dancers? Did you see hula dancers? There are sort of, natives enacting this exotic ritual tradition. So and people are sort of standing around them and, sort of clicking away. What very few people realize is that a number of those groups were actually paid by Kodak to give you more picture-taking opportunities. Similarly, they went around American highways, and I'm talking about the 1930s here, and put up 3,000 or 4,000 signs saying Vista ahead. Some of those you will still find there. Essentially, here's another picture-taking opportunity, a Kodak moment. that must not be missed. Okay? So this is how the Kodak moment is being created. Okay? Who's going to be taking pictures and what those pictures are going to be of and when. And everything is being constructed in these decades. And then, of course, there was the album which the family could come together and see. Of course, what you must also realize is that if you go through, these are social experiments anyone can do. I mean, you just go through people's photo collection. What themes do you see there? Who are the subjects? Family. So there'll be picture of friends and family.
Significant events.
Significant events. Essentially, significant events.
For the family.
And for the family. So, these are the two themes that... And they'll all be happy pictures. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
If you go through people's albums, it's like they haven't had a moment of sorrow. They've all led model lives. Yes. And they've never had a fight. That is also Kodak's doing. Because before Kodak came, there was space for sorrow in photography. Because remember, we are going back 100 years, infant mortality was high. People used to take pictures or have pictures taken of their recently deceased children and put them on mantelpieces. Kodak came in and erased all traces of sorrow from photography. But this was a great marketing tactic, because what they were allowing you to do is reconstruct your lives through pictures, just like you reconstruct your lives through Facebook these days. If you go to your Facebook profiles, you're probably the coolest person on the planet, right? You get invited to all these parties and you have all these friends and millions of people wishing you birthdays and whatnot. Extremely popular. So they were giving you an opportunity to essentially reconstruct your lives through that. In fact, how social rituals and norms become embodied in technology, even gender relations become embodied in technology. Somebody gave my 3-year-old nephew a camera, and it was a small plastic camera. And when you push the button, the camera itself said cheese. So that's how cheese came into photography. So photography was nothing like this. This is Kodak's doing, photography as you know it. Of course, Kodak wasn't doing it in a vacuum. There were a number of changes that were coming about in America at those times. Trains, railroads were being laid, so there was greater mobility. Women were coming out, especially with the world wars. They were coming out and they were working. But Kodak picked up on all those things. So in many of their ads, they had women emerging from a motor car or working in a kitchen with all those modern implements like microwaves and so on. So she was modern and at the same time very, very caring. Okay. So this was photography as Kodak had created it. And this is how Kodak understood the world. Photography was essentially practiced by women who were trying to preserve memories. And which memories, that too, was pretty clearly understood. And in comes Sony and Casio with a digital camera. So what happens then? What's the initial reaction from Kodak? The initial reaction from Kodak is actually a very typical reaction of most companies and industries facing a radical technological discontinuity or change. The first reaction generally is ignore it. It'll go away. Hoping it'll go away. And Kodak did exactly the same. But there comes a stage when the press don't leave you alone. They keep asking you these pestering questions. So Sony has released this camera. What do you have to say about this? And you have to say something about it. So you can no longer completely ignore it. So they said, then it's the second reaction, which is you deride it. So this is, Colby Chandler, who was Kodak president in the 1980s when faced with such questions. And he's trying to give you a very elaborate rationale, that why electronic cameras are not going to take off in the foreseeable future. He's saying it is inconceivable that people's need to touch, feel, and pass around hard prints could change. You know what hard prints are called in the photographic industry? They're called social currency because people value them more than actual currency. Every executive that I was interviewing in Kodak headquarters, and you know, in not just Kodak but other companies that were making film too, they would give me one example. When somebody's house catches fire, you know what they go for first? Their pictures. That's the most valuable possession that they have. Do you think they're going to let go of hard prints? The other example they would give me is, remember slide films? When we used to have slideshows in our houses? Once we had prints, did we ever go back to slides? No. People are not going to change their behavior. They like to feel and pass these around. This is social currency. And they used to swear by it. This is the year 2000 I'm talking about. And digital had already been on its way for about 20 years by then. So, one thing that new technologies do is they open up the black box, which had been closed. And so questions that had basically become buried with, as the dust settled down are being asked again. Questions such as, why do we have to pay for developing and printing every 24 exposures? We had started taking it for granted. This is how it is. This must be the most feasible technological solution to our problems. But obviously, it's not. And it never is. Apple could give you the iPod that they're going to, today, that they're going to give you in 3 years. But they're not. Okay? And there are good reasons that Apple has for that. So now they started asking questions. Will people ever compromise on the quality of the image? And Kodak's answer was no. Which is very ironic, of course, because remember they started out with wax films. And their own success was based on that. But none of these executives who were in charge went that far in back in Kodak's history to know about that. Will the customer ever part with hard prints? Again, Kodak's answer was no. Is a modified picture even a real picture? Again, Kodak's answer was no. So this is a big advantage that digital offers us, but who wants to modify pictures? Because it's not a picture anymore. And why do we take pictures? The whole point of taking pictures is to capture reality as accurately as possible. And film was way ahead of digital for a long time. So people will never compromise on quality. They will never part with hard prints. Modifying a photograph is akin to destroying all its value. And we take pictures because we wish to preserve memories. Yeah. So therefore, digital cameras will not. So that was the narrative that was essentially given those days. And for a long time, they were fine. Because this is where the yellow ones are the traditional cameras. Blue ones are digital cameras. And they only started coming on the radar that the sales were significant enough to register on the radar back in the mid-1990s. Why the mid-1990s? Why did it take 15 years for them to get this far?
Yeah, well, it's the only way to see the output was when personal computers took off.
Personal computers, and more than personal computers, the internet. Suddenly, there was a huge boom in the demand for digitized images because websites were coming up all over the place and they all needed digitized pictures. So what was Kodak's response now? Now the writing was pretty much on the wall. Their response, there were two responses. One was, okay, so sales start sagging. What's the response? I think what people need are smaller cameras. So they gave you APS, advanced photo system, which was, I think, 19 millimeter, if I remember correctly, rather than 35 millimeter. And DX coding on the film, so you could tell the camera, I need two prints of this particular picture that I'm taking, and so on. So there was, it's always incremental, the response. The second was photo CD. Okay, so you want digitized images? Well, keep taking pictures on film, take it to the photo finisher, they will give it back to you as a set of hard prints, which we know you love, but also on a CD that you can plug into your laptop, and you have a set of high-quality digitized images, which you could not have had had you taken the picture in the first place with a digital camera, because they would not give you the same quality. Neither of them were enough to save Kodak, as we know now. Okay. So the first reaction was, ignore it. The second was, deride it. And the third was, co-opt it. Give you photo CD, which is the hybrid, which is marriage of basically, or you know, the best of both worlds. Why was Kodak holding on? I mean, one reason was very clear. The gross margins on film are huge. They're close to 70 or 80%. It's a very, very lucrative product. And it's so lucrative because only two companies in the world could make film of that quality, Kodak and Fuji. So it's a highly specialized business, which meant very, very high margins. And what are the margins in electronic hardware? Close to zero. Almost all the cameras are made in China and Taiwan and other Far Eastern countries. When manufacturing starts moving to the Far East, you can know that there are no more margins to be made in manufacturing. Now, how do you give up something that gives you 70% margins to something that gives you below 10% margins? So there was a very clear financial decision too involved in there. The second thing is, Kodak had built their market. You can have the world's best innovation sitting in your lab and it won't make you a dime if it's not for all the other things that you have. Take the product to market, be able to sell it, appeal to customers. They had all that. They had a huge global distribution system. They had one of the world's biggest brands, and they had an unparalleled ability to market to women, which they had essentially cultivated over many, many years. Now, what did digital do? They turned women into men. From sentimental pictures that Kodak had taught us to take, we went to casual pictures. And from preserving memories, we went to sharing of experiences. So how does Kodak begin to adapt to this new world? From 70% women, suddenly you went to 80% men with digital cameras in the initial years. This is all Photo Marketing Association international data. Kodak didn't know how to market to men. Men were not the family archivists. And what's worse, men did not print their pictures out. They just left it on camera. So how does Kodak make any money? Once you've bought an electronic camera or a digital camera, you can take as many pictures as you like. The company that sold you the camera doesn't make any more money. Very unlike the film business, which was essentially razor and blade business. They give razors away for free because they know they can sell the blades to you. So it was the film. Kodak never went into high-end cameras because a $5 camera uses the same film as a $5,000 camera. And they made their money from film. Now, their marketing ability, of course, also suffered a setback because they really prided themselves on making these ads which tugged on people's heartstrings. And then they watched sales go up. And now, the kind of pictures that people were taking with digital cameras started to change. Prior to that, photography used to peak twice at two occasions in a year. Which were those?
Christmas
family
holiday.
Reunion, and?
Holidays,
vacations. Right? Now it was getting flatter. People were taking pictures all around the year. So the whole sort of behavioral, you know, side of it was shifting. The assumptions that had gone into building a particular universe of this is what photography means to people, this is what photographs mean, everything was changing. So this is, you know, Kodak came to it later on. Now it's no longer preserve, it's share. Because sharing is very different from preserving, of course. How many of the pictures that are emailed to you do you actually preserve? And compare, yeah, I mean, I can speak for myself. I mean, I preserve, I don't know, less than 10% of it. And, you know, while knowing that there is no negative here, this is it. Once I press the delete button, this thing is gone. In hard prints, we had negatives. So you could actually go back and make more prints. And yet, how many hard prints have you actually torn up and thrown away in your life? Almost none. I can bet that in your photographer, you know, photographic collection, there are some images that you cannot tell what this is a picture of. And yet, they're there. You haven't thrown them away. So our relationship with photos has become completely different now. We are fine with having a picture just on a screen, which Kodak thought would never ever happen. Because people like hard prints. We have learned to live without hard prints. Kodak became a little confused. And let me show you this ad. Because on one hand, you know, they're saying share. They're sort of trying to adapt to a new digital environment. On the other hand, what would you do without YouTube? Right? So, can you hear? How do I raise the volume? So can you see the two different strands here? So they're trying to adapt, but they're not venturing very far. And they keep coming back to base camp. Let me see how I... So, what happened? They had the resources, and yet they resisted the new technology. Like many other companies before them, and probably after them, they tried to perpetuate the life of the existing technology because it was lucrative, and it ensured Kodak's competitive advantage. It tried to find hybrid solutions, and Kodak is not, by any means, the only company to follow this path. Was too tied to these complementary assets like brand and distribution system, so on and so forth, because these are the assets that had made it a lot of money. And they tried to do digital from the Kodak city, which is Rochester. And I have come under a lot of fire for suggesting that they should have moved to the West Coast while trying, because the entire Rochester turned against me. What do you have against Rochester? I have nothing against Rochester. But this was essentially a company town which grew around Kodak. Kodak was the provider. in there. Lots of companies have come up in Rochester around Kodak. You know, Bausch & Lomb,
yeah.
Ray-Bans, you know, glasses, so on. There were two brothers who were basically making lenses for Kodak, sitting in Rochester. That's how they became a split company. So there are a number of other examples like that. So the kind of feedback that you get in that particular environment, so literally and metaphorically, it doesn't allow you to move very far from your core competencies. So Kodak always remained very, I mean, one of the things that they launched was KodakGallery.com, which was previously known as O-Photo, I think. And if you go there, you see very quickly that it's essentially a digital version of their analog offerings. You can have your picture printed on a mug. You can have your printed, you know, picture printed on a t-shirt. I mean, we could do this stuff 30 years ago. There's nothing new there. Meanwhile, people are doing some completely different things with pictures. So if you remain close to your core strengths or what have made you successful, chances are the same thing will lead you to your downfall too. Because your core capabilities essentially become core rigidities over time. The same things prevent you from reconceptualizing the world around you. Because the meaning is central to all this. The meaning of photography, what photography meant to people, how they practiced it, what photographs meant to people, was all changing. And yet, Kodak's behavior was largely rooted in their historical understanding of what photography was all about.
Thank you.
Xerox?
Innovation, and then how 3M compares to those two models,
yeah.
Kodak and Parker. I think they have this culture of constantly innovating things.
Xerox problem was slightly different, but they were good at creating value, but very, very poor at capturing that value. I mean, the PC that I'm using here, who do you think invented the PC? Xerox. The mouse that I'm using here, who invented that? Xerox. The graphical user interface that Apple introduced, who invented that? Xerox. But they just couldn't connect it with the market. They had all the technologies sitting there. They were very poor at connecting it to the market. 3M is a more interesting example because that allows me to make another point, which is central to this, which is about American capitalism. Part of the blame for Kodak's demise must also go to American brand of capitalism. Because 3M is a multi-product company, which makes it a safer bet because you have a diverse portfolio of products. Not all of them have to succeed. Some of them, as long as some of them stay up in the air, you can survive the lean periods. Kodak was essentially a single product. I mean, there were other parts of the business which were more professional and, you know, the film for electron microscopy and so on, but they were very, very small parts of the business. Most of the money came from the mass market and film. What prevents American companies from diversifying? The shareholder system. The shareholders say, we are putting money in your company because we think film is lucrative. So stick to that, because if we wanted you to diversify, we'd just diversify directly. We would go and buy stock in other companies. So let us do the diversification. So it's great for, you know, the winds of creative destruction, as Schumpeter used to call it, but not so great for the companies that are involved. Because they actually get penalized for spreading themselves too thinly across different businesses. So the system forces you to put all your eggs in the same basket.
Thank you. Rudolph?
Yes. point. I think you address them. It's a brilliant talk, by the way. But I think you address them towards the end. And one is, Kodak was really a single product market. They were making medium. They were not producing cameras in any meaningful way. And when the digital photography, the medium effectively disappeared, they were not capable of moving into the market for the cameras in any meaningful way. They were trying various sorts of things. And the other way, I recently saw a very interesting slide which Herman Hauser prepared, mm-hmm. which is looking at top 10 companies at the NASDAQ in the United States, and looking at companies in Europe, and how every 20 years. And it's very interesting how those 10 companies in the United States constantly change. It's, you know, 20 years ago, the 10 companies are not the same companies.
Yes.
And I imagine Rochester perhaps was a little bit kind of a good old solid state.
Yes.
And kept the
going. That's right. I mean, they were extremely dominant in their industry. At one point in time, they had 80% market share in the U.S. of the extremely lucrative film market. And, you know, photography just persisted for such a long time. And when you're this dominant, you're able to survive for longer. So there are some companies that have survived, GE and so on and so forth. But many of those are actually multi-product, multi-division companies in meaningful ways. Kodak actually was not bad at making digital cameras. You know, its EasyShare cameras, for example, won several awards. And you know how Kodak survived for the last 10 years? I mean, I used to tell them about 7 years ago that it's about time for you to, you know, either completely change your act or you're going to be history. How did they survive for the last 7 or 8 years? Essentially through the intellectual property that they had developed. Because they have all these patents that people are using now, and they developed those 20 years ago. And they are selling those patents and surviving. They've become, in a way, they became patent trolls. So they're basically going left, right, and center suing companies for infringement of patents. It's their lawyers who kept the company going for the last 7 or 8 years, not the management. Because the management put their hands up. I mean, they didn't put their hands up. They kept plowing more money into this thing, but didn't really come up with a coherent business model for this new age, because they kept searching for the razor and blade model again.
Another puzzle, which you didn't really touch on much. I have a very high-end, very expensive camera,
mm-hmm.
which is made in Germany.
Right.
But the sensor in it is made by Kodak. So it is kind of extraordinary that they could have the leading edge technology in this particular, at the heart of this technology, and yet blow it.
That's right. Because technology never matters. It's basically the model, how you take it. It's the technology is creation of, you know, value. You have innovated, right? But now you need to capture it. So like the example that I gave of Xerox, you know, they came up with pioneering technologies, but never really made much money from it. So these guys had it, but in their case, of course, what they didn't want was to cannibalize their existing lucrative business, which is a very, very tough decision. So one of the things that they could have done is, of course, invested in lots of small companies, you know, students, told them to go locate in incubators on the West Coast, just experiment with different things about pictures. They could have owned Facebook. So, but again, you know, I mean, partially it's because they kept it very close to Rochester. I mean, the digital imaging division, they had a digital imaging division, they had very smart people in that division, but every ad that they took out was seen as a shot across the goal by the consumer, the much more powerful consumer imaging division.
Yeah.
Somebody at the back and then to the back.
Have you looked at the idea that it was actually Apple that replaced what they were doing? Because what the problem wasn't the camera, it was how people were going to display and store images.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple provided all the technology and the software for doing that, more or less coming in at the same time as Kodak, and finally declined away. So if you're looking for a substitution sort of set of technologies or business model.
I think more than Apple, you know how most people take their pictures now. on their phones.
Yeah.
So it was basically Nokia which started providing this service. Apple came in much later, in 2008, I believe, with the iPhone. And, you know, smartphone was a very small part of the total mobile phone market. And they have, you know, they have been increasing their share in that, but they still remain a small part of the, you know, entire film market.
I don't remember which year iPhoto came out, but already the iPod was, even before, it wasn't really the iPhone, it was the precursors of that, which were creating this possibility of, you know, passing a small gadget with a screen on it around and so on, replacing exactly the things he was showing us.
Yes.
And in fact, that vanity camera going back to the 1920s and the simplicity of the work, I mean, there's a tremendous similarity between those colored anodized iPods.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
A remarkable
yes.
Mirror of the
yes. Yes. No, certainly. Well, I mean, there may be something to it which we need to probably you know, talk more about.
And Apple have managed to capture the margin as well.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. I mean, they're a key differentiator, so that's their strategy. Yeah.
But I was just going to say, I think your point about it was the internet, and in particular it was broadband, it was having networks that were just a bit faster than modems. What Kodak had was the means of sharing your memories. And I think email, and to some degree the web, replaced that once it was feasible to share those
memories.
And that's why the camera companies didn't kill Kodak in a way. It was the importance of the
web. Yes.
Thanks very much. What I find interesting, though, is that Fujifilm has survived very well.
They diversified successfully.
So
Japanese capitalism is quite different.
Yes. So was it a failure of Kodak management then? That one first
no, I mean, like I said, you know, I wouldn't like to heap all the blame at their door. These were tough decisions to make, and, you know, I mean, they are constrained by their shareholders, too, and analysts. I mean, in management literature, we have, you know, significant evidence of companies' stock being discounted if they diversify. Japanese seem to be more tolerant of this practice.
I've you've obviously studied this a lot more than most of us here, but it's did not come down to a cultural issue, because there are also a lot of instances of very successful shareholder-owned companies who do diversify as part of their life work. Sony has done it, they're in trouble.
Another Japanese company.
Well, Intel then. That turns on its actually. I mean, there are IBM has done it successfully.
Yes.
Is there not just an even wind? I think Christensen's analysis of this drive was that they were piggybacking each other
yes.
rather than stopping. Whereas Kodak basically had one trick pony and did nothing more with it for 70 years. I mean,
Intel did do that early on. IBM basically essentially almost went bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were allowed to do that. And that is quite a transformation, more of an exception, because they were one of the world's largest manufacturing companies, and they went to becoming one of the largest service companies.
Yeah.
This is a spectacular turnaround. And culture figures very, very prominently in that, because, you know, here you are, you have a sales force of thousands who are basically trained and completely entrenched in this mentality of IBM is the best company in the world, and IBM makes the best products in the world. So nothing else compares. And they become a service company, a consulting company, and suddenly they have to, you know, recommend their competitive solutions to you. So the kind of turnaround that they managed is quite fascinating.
And then maybe you had the shock of bankruptcy, of pending bankruptcy, help them do that. Is it possible that Kodak will be able to use the shock, but also the protection of Chapter 11 or whatever?
Yeah.
To reemerge, or are they...
Well, I mean, sir, if they go take the route of the... take a leaf out of IBM's book, or Lou Gerstner, who was heading IBM at the time's book, then certainly, I mean, they could reemerge. They'll be a very different company, though. They have to stop looking for this razor and blade sort of model and completely reconceptualize themselves and, come to terms with how the environment has completely changed around them. The people who were taking pictures, the type of pictures that are being taken, what people do with pictures, everything has changed. So, which is what the company was built around.
Yeah.
Michael, you mentioned the influence between women and men. What about generational?
impact did that have on the change from...
Well, certainly, generational change matters here, because our children are growing up with, basically just knowing. I mean, when I was growing up, remember when I saw my first PC, I didn't know where the on button was on that thing, and I was scared to press it, you know, lest I destroy the whole thing and press some wrong button. And now, the nephew that I mentioned early on who got this camera, somebody else gave him a plastic laptop. And remember, he's 3 years old. The first question he asked, it's a plastic, you know, colorful keys, and it makes all these sounds and pictures and so on and so forth. The first question he asked is, does it have YouTube? my 10-year-old is downloading all kinds of apps from iTunes and making movies with all kinds of special effects, and I have absolutely no idea how he does that. So, they are much more comfortable. They know how to navigate these menus and go through these things. And most of us, when we use PCs, we use Microsoft Word or Excel or perhaps one other software that may be necessary for our job. These guys are going and doing lots of things with that. So it's once again challenging existing mindsets about what computers are, how you navigate through them, menu-driven interfaces and so on. So, yes, I mean, these guys, when these classes that are coming in now that I'm teaching, in the new undergraduate classes, I have to actually ask them, before telling them about technological evolution, have you ever seen a typewriter? And you know what? Now there are students coming in who never have.
Yeah.
They don't know what a typewriter is. So it's a very, very different game.
Okay. Well, I think we should stop there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.